was really sweet. Thank you, Safi. Hi, everybody. My name is Nancy. I'm a grateful alcoholic, happy recovering alcoholic, lucky. It's wonderful to be a part of this conference. Speakers are gifted, loving, good people, and it's just, I don't know. It's one of my favorite things to do, actually. Hang out with you guys, and I had to go home and put on the birds. I'm very lucky, privileged to be able to do this. And I know that there's someone here who's having a great time like I'm having, or there's someone here maybe who's not having such a great time. I know there might be somebody here that's new. There might be somebody here who's worried, or somebody here who's lost something. And I just want you to know I've felt feelings like that too. And AA is not a place that promises us a rose garden, for sure. Many of us know that. But we do have a way to live. We have a way to live through many things, through our own mistakes, and through, you know, just things that happen to you that aren't much fun, or just those growing spurts. You know, you talk about the hard times that you have. You know, I had, when I was new, Safi, this is, I came into AA and everybody was laughing. And I thought, these people are stupid. Because if you were happy, you were stupid. You know, don't they read the paper? Don't they know all the trouble that I've seen? You know, and so I didn't understand at all about how to have a good time. I didn't understand very much. I had, from just drinking, I really lost a lot of my chops, things that people just know I couldn't do anymore. I didn't know how to dress, and I didn't know how to speak without cursing, and because I spoke the language of cool. When you're cool, you've only got four words to work with. And three of them are wow. So I was quite limited, and I didn't know what stuff was. And so you had to get re-enculturated into life. And so my first sponsor was a short little woman, and she drove one of those old Volkswagens with a convertible Volkswagen Bug. So it was like a little baby buggy. And we went to a party. I had 5 days of sobriety, and we went to an AA party. Well, good grief. You know, I mean, I had never seen such a thing. And I remember it was in West Hollywood, and there were some men dressed up as women, and there was just a lot of different people to look at and loud talk. The thing that got to me when I was a newcomer was everyone spoke in sentences. That was bizarre. I mean, they had subjects and verbs and objects of the prepositions. They said whole things, you know. I just grunted and cussed. And anyway, but I remember that we went to this party, and my sponsor had a respectably sober person who had some time with her, a friend. And they sat in the front, and my sponsor stuffed me in this little baby carriage Volkswagen in the back, I guess, what do they call it, a rumble seat? And I just sat back there and eavesdropped on what they had to say about this party. And as we pulled away from the curb, they said to each other, wasn't that a good time? And I sat in the back so serious, I thought, oh, that's a good time. Oh, so that's a good time. Because I didn't know what a good time really was. I didn't know a lot of things by the time I got here. I'd unlearned a lot. And I was, you know, just you know, all the human beings can get in, I think. I think this is a terrible disease. I think it's the worst thing in the world because there's no cure for alcoholism. We only have a treatment, but it's a wonderful treatment. And it's the only one that's worked for 75 years or whatever, however old we are, I can't remember. But this is a fantastic way of life, but you have to get to death's door, you know? And we do. We do. I've had a good time this weekend. I went to Safi's house for a fabulous little spread and fellowship and sisterhood. And then we went to see the Chief Seattle's grave. That was a big thrill for me. That was pretty cool. Read that inscription with dust that loves you on your feet. And I thought, that's pretty good, dust that loves you. You know what I'm talking about? That thing that's all around us. Amazing. And then today we had a good time. I got to catch up on my sleep and order extra coffee. And, you know, I'm in my element here, you know, and what I've learned so much. I've learned that we practice this thing everywhere that we go. And there's just so much has happened. When I was a kid, I was lonely, and because alcoholics are lonely, and I'm a born alcoholic. Honest to God, I think I am. My mom carried me for 10 months. You know, usually it's 9 months. But I was up there. You know, I must have had my little fins pressed against the uterine wall, and I was just going, no, I don't want to be born, you know? And then I was born, and I was a victim. So there you go. And my start in this world, my mom and dad drove out to California from Pennsylvania on the wings of an American dream. My dad was a hotshot writer on the LA Times. He had been a writer in Pittsburgh, and they had this romantic meeting, and my two sisters were in the back seat. They drove to Glendale, California. Now, Glendale is very near where I live today. A lot of you have asked me, where's Tujunga? Tujunga is an old community in the foothills, that kind of these little cities in the foothills about 20 minutes from downtown LA and Hollywood, but it's kind of rooted together. There's Tujunga and La Cañada and La Crescenta and Pasadena start. So I should have just said LA, but I like to play with people and say Tujunga. But Glendale is near there, so I'm a native-born Californian. They drove out to Glendale. My dad had this big job in the LA Times, and they bought a big house on Mountain Street in Glendale. And this was the American dream. And the house was full of writers and musicians. Music has always been a major part of my whole life. And my mom used to tell me, she said, they were good Catholics, you know, good Catholic family. And my mom said, oh, we didn't plan for you. Now, she didn't say it like that, but I heard it like that. She said it probably kind of nice, you know, but I heard her say, we didn't plan for you. And then she said, and we really wanted a boy. But she didn't say it like that, you guys. You see, I was born with a hearing problem. So I used to hear things funny. And I was also born with antenna. I still have it. They're retracted right now. But when they're out, they're about 10 or 15 feet long. And I can tell what the guy in the back of the room is feeling, because I'm responsible for it. So, you know, a very, very important person. And so anyway, I was born with like this, and my mom told me that she said, we didn't plan for you. She said, you were a menopause baby. I don't even think they say that anymore. But, you know, that just meant I got there before the door shut, you know. And that's been the story of my life. I get there right when the door shuts. Oops, I just made it. And But she said my dad was crazy about me. She said that he would rush home from work and throw me on his shoulders and run around the house. And she said, you were the laughingest baby. He just made you laugh till bedtime. And when I was 18 months old, I had just started to speak. And some of my first words were, Daddy. But one May morning in 1951, my dad died on the kitchen floor. And I was there. And she told me, you just toddled around his head. And she said, you kept saying, that's a daddy, that's a daddy. And those were probably the last words he heard. And that was that turned out to be later in my life kind of important to me. Hope I remember to tell you about it. But that was a terrible thing. That event shaped my family. That shaped a lot of things about me. That shaped a lot of things about my sisters. And it kind of affected my mom in a big way. My mom was tough. She didn't know anybody out here except my dad's brothers and all those people, cousins and so forth. Her sisters were still back east, and so when this terrible death had happened, and she her sisters all said, well, we'll each take a girl because we don't want to take that big of a bunch. We'll take one at a time. And my mom said no, she was going to keep us together. So I'm cut from that cloth. And my mom in 1951, Irish, sold the big house, bought a little duplex in Glendale Avenue, and moved all the little girls in one side. And there was no single parent support, and it was kind of a shame if you lost your husband and you were on your own. And my mom did it. She got us. We went to Catholic school, and all that pain kind of hung in the corners of the house. And I tell you something, I'm so thankful for Alcoholics Anonymous, because our way of life, what we share, our inventories, our amends, they unwind you so that you can begin to understand. And through my sobriety, I've learned to understand my early beginnings and my mother and my sisters. But there was this pain hanging from the ceilings all the time, and it was, loss, and it was all this thing. My oldest sister had a terrible time. She has a lot of emotional problems. She's a brilliant human being with many, many emotional problems. Started in our childhood, and it continues to this day. And I felt guilty. I always felt like if I hadn't been born, my dad would have lived. You see how it is? It's crazy emotions. They usually don't have any reason attached to them. And believe me, no one ever said that to me. But I took it all personal. And that's what we do, some of us. Some of us that are kind of born with this makeup, we're very, very sensitive people, very take it very personal. And I always felt if I hadn't been born, my mom's life would have been better. And my dad would have lived. And that's all unwound now. I'm just sharing it now. I don't believe it. But I do believe that I'm a very self-centered person. I have a funny story to tell you. I want to bring back the mood a little bit. I'm a college teacher, and I was teaching a literature class a couple months ago. And part of the class, to get ready for the day's work, I'll read this for our discussion. I was going to read a definition of narcissism that's put out by the American Psychiatric Association, whoever they are, whatever their titles are. But it's the official, from the book, description of a narcissist. I thought, well, that'll be good. That'll set up this thing that we're studying. I did not read it before class. I just thought that'll work because that's going to set up what this author says in this assignment. So I thought, what I'll do, so the first thing I'll kick off the discussion by reading this definition. So my students are sitting there dutifully, I'm a professor, I said, now let me read you guys this. And I started reading this thing, and I had never read it before, so I'm, holy crap! It says that the narcissist thinks the whole world is all about them, it's too painful to memorize, believe me, but There's one thing we narcissists suffer with, and it's this. We do not care about the other person's integrity when we mess with them. Something to that effect. And that just stopped me cold. And I felt that rush of gratitude again. But here's what I did in class. I'm reading this thing, and you know how we just burst with insights in AA meetings, and we got to share, and it just comes right out. I kind of rolled out with one of those. I said, you guys, that's me and all my friends. And they laughed, you know. But it was just sweet. It was kind of like, yeah, laugh at her, humor her. But, you know, this is something that our program teaches us about. And I very much appreciated Sue's reminding us tonight that Al-Anon has a different treatment from the alcoholic. It's the same 12 steps, but you ride different horses in opposite directions. Because I have to learn how to think about other people. I have to learn to be very concerned if my actions affect their integrity, you know. And it's a different story on the other side. So, but anyway, as a kid, I was very self-centered and very guilty and felt very responsible. And the one gift, as I mentioned, was music. God gave me a beautiful voice and a wonderful ear and good teachers. And everybody played and sang. This, my troubled older sister, she used to just... Music just treated her. I would sit under the coffee table and look across the room at her when she was 15 years old, and she would belt Summertime, and that it seemed to cure her, because I knew how angry and upset she was, and she would sing, and that music would cure her. And do you know, she stopped. But I couldn't believe that. But I would watch music cure her, and I loved the radio, and I loved the choir at church, and I could sing. Something happened to me when I sang that was good. It was a wonderful feeling. It made sense of the world, and music made sense of everything for me. It was my redemption and my relief. As a kid, I loved it. As a kid, I escaped in there. I escaped into music, escaped into reading, and escaped into TV. Because the house was always so unhappy. And I kind of have this idea about families as being an unhappy place. Things were just sad there. And but, you know, I could watch TV and escape into that. I used to love that show, The Millionaire. It was a show called The Millionaire where this guy knocked on the door of a deserving family every week and presented them with a tax-free million-dollar check. And the rest of the show unfolded, and it was whatever it was that week. But I used to think, if that guy would just come help my mom. And of course he never did. It was TV. But kids with antenna are really sensitive, you know. So we trucked along, and I eventually, inside of me, all this, I always wanted to know about my dad. I never got to know enough stories about my dad, because you couldn't tell me enough stories about my dad. I wanted to know what he was like and why we didn't have one, and why didn't my mom just remarry and get another boyfriend so I could be happy. And my sisters were growing up, and they didn't seem as bothered as I was. Nobody ever seemed as bothered as I was to me. And they were cute, and I was goofy looking. When I grew up, I got goofy looking. I had crooked teeth. I had a bad complexion. I wasn't a cute little figured girl. I was gawky. I wasn't an athlete. I was just a tall, gawky girl who walked at the end of the line in Catholic school with the other gawky girls. And my ears stuck out. I had ears like file folders. I did. And they were just out. And my mom took pity on my ears, and I was one of the first children to ever have plastic surgery ever. I had this turban on my head. And they're stuck back there now, real good. They'll never come out. But this just fed my less than, you know, I just felt like dirt all the time. But the only time I got the relief was because I could sing. I could sing circles around anybody. Had a beautiful voice. And that was God's gift, you know. And I just, but I kept having all these feelings that I couldn't take anywhere. They were just inside of me. I was trying to be a good Catholic school girl. And I went on a train trip with my mom. She did get a boyfriend in Washington, in Tumwater. We took a train trip to Olympia and then got off the train, and but it didn't work out. But we were on that train ride, and I was molested by a stranger on that train, and I felt so guilty. And I never told my mom. I never told my mom. I never told anybody until I had to write it down in a forcep. And my mom never knew, because I just did not want to add that to all her troubles. By the time I was 12 years old, I had all this fury inside of me, shame, anger, frustration, and music. It was crazy, wasn't it? And just crazy feelings. And I said, to heck with being good. I started running around with the other gangsters in Catholic school. And they thought I was funny, and they told me about boys, which was a huge mystery to me. Now, everyone's hormones are raging, and puberty has just set in. And I don't know anything about boys, and everyone's talking about boys. And so my friends filled me in, and we started smoking cigarettes and reading movie magazines, and I started stealing because I thought the world owed me, and because I didn't care, and because it was so much fun. It was so much fun to run around and commit all these little crimes with my little friends. And we stole some vodka one morning on the way to Catholic school, and we took it into the bathroom, little girls' restroom in a grammar school, and bought orange juice, and I had that first drink, and it was great. I'm a born alcoholic. My DNA embraced alcohol because it was an answer. I drank for help. I needed that help because the alcohol did for me what nothing had ever done. It was just as good as music, if not better. And I had that drink, and it was just great, and I needed another drink. And I don't know, we had a couple belts in there, and the bell rang, and we were back to religion class. And I turned my will and my life over to what that feeling was. It was such a good feeling. It was so nice to feel like I could take it all. It was so nice to feel like all this trouble was no big deal. It was so nice to be an alcoholic. In those early days, you know. And I didn't understand this language that we speak. I had to walk in here, and you told me this was a physical disease. I didn't believe it right away. And I hung in here about 4 months of sobriety. I was sitting in a meeting in Hollywood at a place called Joe's Place. That's a good name, isn't it? Joe's Place. It sounds like a bar. I love meetings that sounded like they were going to be cool, you know. I didn't go to meetings with nice titles like Seeking Serenity, but Joe's Place, I went there. And I'm sitting in Joe's Place when I heard it. For the first time, I heard that Dr. Silkworth had said that we alcoholics are the only class of drinkers who, when we have any alcohol at all, we develop the phenomena of craving. And when I heard those words and I had 4 months of sobriety, I got it all the way to my toes, the identification that is so critical for you and I. It is so much the heart of the deal, which is why I love stories, because I have to identify with you as an alcoholic before I get that miracle. And it happened to me that day. Just to hear that phenomena of craving made me salivate. Made me thirsty. I thought, oh, I know exactly what they mean. Because I always drank to go downtown. I drank for drunkenness. I never did drink to just fit in, you know, like the people on the social pages. I was putting my little finger out, you know, people that drank like this. I never drank like this. I was a serious drinker from the very beginning. But back there when I was a kid, it was a great time to be a kid. It was the 60s. I was 1963s when Kennedy was shot. I was in junior high by then. I got out of Catholic school. I went to public school, and I was working on my image to be a bad girl, and I ratted my hair high. so that I would look bad. Now I'm a innate born coward. I'm a frightened person, but I wanted to look ferocious. And because the girls in East LA did that. Now I just look kind of silly, but they used to do this ratting thing. And then they would put razor blades in those hairdos for fights. You know? I never put any razor blades in my hair because I didn't want to get hurt. But and I wore a lot of makeup, and I wore this white lipstick. We all wore white lipstick. Your lips were so white they came in the room before you did. And we just hung around, you know, and we discovered older boys and fraternity parties and drinking. And most of all, I discovered Hollywood, which in the mid-60s was exciting. And the music was exciting. Wow, the music, wow. And the culture was breaking apart. The 50s culture was breaking apart, and everybody was saying no, no to this war, no to these problems, civil rights, women's rights, all this stuff. I mean, what a great time to be a defiant alcoholic. I tell you, I didn't know much of what was going on, but I loved to protest. I finally learned about the 60s in like 87. Yeah, I took a class. The class was called America in the 60s. This is a great decade to lose, by the way. If you've lost the 80s, too bad. But the 60s are on everybody's bookshelf now, so you can take a class in it. Well, I took this class, and there it says there's women's rights and civil rights, and we went to the moon? Really? That's incredible. So I got to catch up on my decade. But back then it was I was living this life of the artiste, of the people I admired, Allen Ginsberg and some of the beatniks. Some of them hated hippies too, but I didn't realize that then. Jack Kerouac and you know the beatniks were on their way out and the hippies were coming in. And folk music, I love this music tonight. It just so reminded me of those days because they used to be it, you know, in the coffee houses, these guys be singing, you know, Peter, Paul, Mary, oh, Puff the Magic Dragon, you know. Don't you miss those days? Puff. Anyway, I was just running away to Hollywood and I was breaking my mother's heart. And I had a funny experience about 2 years ago. I was invited to share at a conference in LA somewhere, and it was a nice gathering. And afterwards, a man came up to me and he said, he was a tall fellow, big fellow, big tall fellow with gray hair. And he said to me, "You're going to want to make amends to me when I tell you who I am." How's that for an opener? And then he told me who he was. Turns out he was the little brother of my friend that we stole vodka from her mother to have that first drink. And he said, "You used to pick on me." He said, You used to pin my ears back," and I could see that he hadn't had the operation I had. He said, "You used to pin my ears back with scotch tape and tickle me till I peed." And I said, "I was very, very sorry, you know. Can I buy you some scotch tape?" You know, but it was a little gift of AA, you know, when these people kind of come back. He's actually like kind of a nice friend now today, and it was fun. But anyway, back then we were kids trying to be as bad and goofy as we could and terrible and sing this music. And I never went to school. I just got through high school with D stops because of the music. That was easy, and I went to music, but I didn't go to anything else if I could avoid it. I had a reputation as a ringleader, and I was just a lost kid. I was discovering LSD, and I smoked pot, and I took pills, and many of us do, all the way back to the early days, you know, We are very addicted.